From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we explore how white flight doesn't only happen in low-income areas.
Cupertino is a place that was about 90% white, and now it's 29% white.
Then we'll visit a tiny parcel of land under a large billboard where volunteers are building a comfortable home for bees.
And it's interesting being in such a meditative space, 50 feet away from a freeway.
The story of Visitation Valley's bee farm. And for this week's audiograph, we take you to a Bay Area spot that's unusually quiet.
The stillness and the silence allow me to recognize what's going on in the undertone.
Listen closely. It's Cross Currents. Last June marked a much-anticipated achievement for the U.S. Congress, the passing of the Immigration Reform Bill.
The yeas on this bill are 68. The nays are 32. The bill, as amended, is passed.
What that meant was many things. A new path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, mainly Latinos. The abolition of the diversity lottery visa that brought in thousands of African immigrants. And an increase of H-1B visas given to highly talented workers sponsored by companies here in the U.S., primarily tech workers from East and South Asia. Silicon Valley tech giants like Yahoo, Facebook, and Google lobbied Congress and even wrote to the president to increase the number of these visas in the new immigration bill. So what does that mean for Silicon Valley besides more tech workers? What social effects have high-skilled immigrant Asian families had on traditionally white South Bay cities and the people who've lived in them for generations? Stanford sociology professor Tomas Jimenez asked himself those questions and studied the city of Cupertino as an example. His latest study is called When White is Just All Right, How Immigrants Redefine Achievement and Reconfigure the Ethno-Racial Hierarchy. What he found, he says, was totally unexpected, as he told me when I sat down with him in his Stanford office.
Cupertino is a place that was, in 1980, about 90% white. And now it's 29% white. Most people know it because it's the headquarters of Apple Computer, right? It's the default setting on their iPhone when they first get it. But it's also a very significant area of high-skilled immigrant settlement. Most of the immigrants there come from India or China. And the immigrants tend to be very highly educated. It's a very expensive place to live. It's very upper middle class, even by Silicon Valley standards. And the white population that lives there is also very solidly upper middle class. So they have very kind of equal class standing. And like a lot of places, there's a strong stereotype that has developed about Asian youth being very high achieving, being very hardworking, being smart. It's actually not a surprise. A lot of people would call this the kind of model minority stereotype. What's different about Cupertino than that kind of model minority stereotype is that the stereotypes about Asians have significant implications for how whites get stereotyped there. Typically, in a mixed setting, whiteness, the idea of being white, stands for high achievement, right? And so, you know, there's some research, and this is somewhat controversial research, that has found that minority kids accuse each other of acting white, and part of that includes some kind of achievement component. A lot of that has been debunked, but it's out there, and so I'll mention it. There's a notion that the white kids are the smart ones, the white kids are the high-achieving ones, they're the kind of standard, the norm to which we compare everyone to figure out how they're doing. But the white kids in Cupertino are not the norm. They're not the standard. The standard and the norm for high achievement is set by the Asian origin population, and particularly the Asian immigrant origin population. And their stereotyping as the smart, high-achieving, high-flying kids necessarily entails, in this place where everyone is either white or Asian, or I should say East or South Asian and white, entails whites being stereotyped as, for lack of a better term, the kind of laggards, the low achievers. And so teachers will tell us that that they often expect less of their white students. Students themselves say that they feel like there are stereotypes that other students have of them, these are white students, that peg them as less smart, as less able, as less capable. And so if you look at a lot of the studies that have been done on poor African Americans, poor Latinos, and their approach to achievement, you can just kind of, and the way that those categories get stereotyped as low achieving, you can just substitute white in there and you essentially have the situation in Cupertino.
So what are white families talking about then in this regard?
One response is that parents decide that they're going to pull their kids out of the schools and put them in less competitive schools, which are often private schools, or seek an interdistrict transfer. I would say that's more of the exception than the rule, but it is an available response to parents.
Because of the pressure their children feel at school?
Because of the pressure, and often because they don't want their kids to be a minority. And so this is very ironic, because white flight usually happens when a minority population moves in. People get afraid that the property values are going down. They get afraid the school quality is going to degrade, and so they pull their kids out. But here, you have a minority population that's moved in. The property values have skyrocketed, and the quality of the schools, at least if you judge by test scores, which is how most people evaluate the quality, have gone through the roof.
The new immigration bill includes a big push by tech companies to increase the number of H-1B visas. So I'm wondering how you see Silicon Valley over the next, 10 years. Right. Is Cupertino going to be all Asian at that point? What does it look like to you?
Given the way that the tech industry drives so many things here, and given the reliance of the tech industry on workers from India and China in particular, there's likely to be a growth in that population. And the fact that there's already a population here, and so immigration is driven in part by networks. So people have friends, family, et cetera, already here. And we often say about, I've studied Mexican immigration for a long time. We often say about Mexican immigration and the kind of reaction of the native population of Mexican immigrants that over time, we've always wanted workers, but we get upset when people show up, and people with lives, people with families, people with a language or the culture, et cetera, et cetera. And what that entails for the potential for conflict and the like. High-skilled immigrants from India and China and Taiwan and Korea, which is where they mostly come from, they're also people. And they come with a language, and they come with a religion, and they come with a culture that has implications, much like those kind of things have implications when Mexican immigrants bring them, who aren't of such a high class status. And so one of the things that I try to show in this research, I think one of the things that's emerging in this research, is that cultural baggage is, for the people who've lived here for a long time, both a source of kind of wonderment and enjoyment, and a source of a painful adjustment.
That's Stanford sociology professor Tomas Jimenez. You can read his study, When White is Just All Right, How Immigrants Redefine Achievement and Reconfigure the Ethno-Racial Hierarchy, on our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. One of the things that makes the Bay Area an attractive place to live is the diversity of our inhabitants, people, and critters. In a city that struggles to find enough space for housing, parking, or children, a few dedicated people have found a luxurious, spacious, and cheap home for bees. On an empty tract of land in San Francisco's Visitation Valley neighborhood, Karen Peter Ross has set up a farm where she and a crew of volunteers are raising honeybees. But honey's not all the farm's about. Peter Ross hopes to give these bees a taste of California's native plants and flowers as well. KALW's Charlotte Silver recently visited and brings us this story.
I meet Karen Peter Ross at the bee farm on a Sunday afternoon. It's on a plot of land on San Bruno Avenue, parallel to Highway 101 and the Bay.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you Karen?
Yeah.
I'm Charlotte.
She's already suited up and at work.
Let me just put this colony back together.
Okay.
While Peter Ross slides bricks over the top of the hive, I slip on the white onesie she gives me and place the veil over my headphones. Then I thread the headphone wire through my sleeve, Velcroing myself up, and I'm ready to enter the apiary. The apiary occupies a corner of the plot and is surrounded by a horseshoe-shaped mound of mulch that helps keep the wind out. There are bees everywhere, about 12 hives, thousands of bees in each one. Over the course of a year, one hive produces around 60 pounds of honey.
For every little dribble of honey, it's like exponential amount of runs of nectar that had to come in. I mean, honey is a dehydrated nectar from flowers, is really what it is. So when you're eating honey, you're eating the, I always say, you're eating the essence of a flower.
The bee farm is covered with flowers, but that's not how it was when Peter Ross found it.
And we spent the first couple of months clearing it because it was like a garbage weed lot, essentially.
She leased the spot from the media company Clear Channel. They've got a billboard on the site. As long as passing motorists can see that billboard, Peteris can do whatever she wants on the ground.
We only pay him $1 a year. We don't even pay that. We give him honey instead, which is actually worth more than $1.
And that's just part of the deal.
We promised that we would take what was an eyesore and turn it into eye candy.
Now it looks cozy. The smoker they use to calm the bees wafts sweet-smelling smoke into the air. The hives are painted bright lavender, cool mint, and white. And there's a huge variety of plants.
And so we have yarrow, we've got African blue basil that bees go crazy for, we've got cosmos, we've got a bunch of native plants.
The bee farm's goal is to nurture the region's various bee populations. That means nurturing the plants that support them.
So we're trying to use native plants that are grown here locally, because hopefully they'll attract our native bees.
Honeybees contribute about $20 billion a year to the U.S. economy, largely by pollinating crops. But around the country, the honeybee population is dropping fast. Over the last 6 years alone, close to 10 million North American beehives have perished. Peter Ross wants to fight that trend and build a robust population of bees in San Francisco.
And the whole purpose is, you know, to feed the bees, and they will come, hopefully, especially the native bees.
Up close, each bee seems almost startlingly individual. As Peter Ross transfers them off one frame into the box, a few baby bees fall to the ground. She gently picks them up by their heads, careful to avoid their stingers, and puts them back in the box.
This is probably a sick bee. See, I dropped her.
She picks up a particularly fragile-looking bee.
This bee was parasitized by the varroa mite. See how it doesn't have any wing? And so the colony was collapsing.
Varroa mites carry bacterial and fungal disease and can destroy entire colonies. Some farmers use a fungicide to fight it, but the fungicide's also linked to a bee-killing disease.
If you're going to be a decent beekeeper, you need to understand the life cycle of the honeybee and then, you know, how to manage to reduce the impact of the mites, whether you do it through integrated pest management or whether you're going to go, you know, hardcore chemicals. We don't go that route, but you know, that's not to say others don't.
Still, plenty of the bees at the bee farm are in good health. The bees returning to their queendoms look like a traffic jam as they crowd around the small entrances of the hives, with chunks of pollen stuck to their tiny bodies. In the winter, they live for just 6 weeks.
They literally work themselves to death.
Busy as a bee is no joke.
Right down in there.
I'm stuck.
You're stuck? There you go.
Some hives react differently to opening them than others, but it's... you train the hive, and they show you what they want. If you're still long enough, you can just feel it. You can see it.
When I meet Peter Ross's apprentice, Joshua DeLeon, he's examining his hive to figure out how much honey to extract and how much to leave in the colony for the winter. He's been working with bees since he was a kid, and he loves it.
Well, what I like is checking the hive, and right now I have a mouthful of wax with raw honey in it. It's the best gum ever. I've never smelled anything quite as healthy as the first time I cracked one of these hives open and just was enveloped in this golden aroma.
The Peaceful Haven has had some interruptions. In late 2013, Clear Channel informed Peter Ross that they wanted to convert part of the land into a parking lot. So the farm started scaling back.
No, we weren't gonna push back or anything. I mean, we're lucky we were able to have this.
Early this year, though, that changed. The city told Clear Channel that it couldn't actually build a parking lot on the site because of zoning. So for now, at least, the bee farm will stay where it is.
We've got lots of wildflower seeds that we're going to toss over these berms. So hopefully the whole berms that surround our apiaries are going to be a carpet of color come March and April.
A garden full of flowers that will make these bees very happy. In San Francisco, I'm Charlotte Silver for Cross Currents.
If you want to see pictures of the Viz Valley Bee Farm, come by our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. It's sweet, like honey.
Here comes the honeyman. Here comes the honeyman.
Honeyman, you got honey in the comb.
Yes, I've got a honey in the comb.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. One garden that Peter Ross's bees might want to check out is the community garden at Mira Loma Elementary School in San Francisco's Mount Davidson neighborhood. That's where third grader Kiana Idgahi goes to school and also tends to a garden plot.
I've learned that if you want to plant something, you can't just put a seed in the ground and expect it to grow. You need to go there every week, more than every week, every 2 days, and water it.
Sometimes Kiana's mother works in the garden too, and one day she found something special there. Kiana shared that story with our Hear Hear community storytelling project. Here it is.
So my mother went to the garden, she was gardening, and she found, in a plot, she found a little caterpillar. She brought it home and we figured out it's a type of caterpillar called an anise swallowtail. For my birthday, my mother got one of those terrariums where it's like a sort of cylinder and you can keep butterflies in it. So we put it in the terrarium and we gave it some anise. We waited about 2 weeks and we watched them and watched them. So it came out and it was a really beautiful butterfly. Like, you know, when you talk about a monarch, the monarch is about the size of about 3 inches long. This butterfly was about the size of a grown-up's palm. So it was pretty big. And I had 5 different colors. It was mostly yellow. I had some red, orange, and blue. Its wings were actually kind of wet, so need to dry off. Then it started flying, and we need to get it out real quickly. Because when it starts flying, it needs to have enough space, or else it might even die. So I took it to the community garden. The person in charge of the community garden told me to put my finger in, and the butterfly will probably come onto your finger. It felt really nice. It was like a tickling feeling. So right then, there were like people from a high school coming. And they were all watching, so it became like a kind of party. So it was really nice. And we let it go.
That was 9-year-old Kiana Idgahi. Her story was produced by Liz Pfeffer for KALW's community storytelling project, Hear Hear. And you can share your story with Hear Hear, too. We'll be coming back to Visitation Valley in February. Find details at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, our sonic treasure hunt. All week long, we've been playing you this sound. We We asked you what you thought that was and where we recorded it. To bring us the answer, we sent KALW's David Boyer to a sacred spot near Muir Beach. It's a place where sound is shaped by a devotion to silence.
Green Gulch is a Zen practice center and organic farm in Marin County, just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. I am Catherine Gammon. My priest name is Yuji Hoshin, and it means courageous word, liberating heart. I am on staff at Green Gulch. I think it's a combination of sounds that would make it specifically Green Gulch that you're hearing. We are silent from the end of the night until silence is broken at breakfast. So the sounds are communicating about schedules, basically. There's a wake-up bell. It's a specific bell, and somebody's job in the morning is to get the bell. And there's a little ritual in the Zendo where you bow and light a candle and go around Green Gulch ringing the bell. And there's a drum that indicates the hour, and then a bell that indicates the portion of the hour. So there are patterns to the sound. They're not music exactly, but they have patterns, and the patterns communicate. They're like a language of sound. The umpan, which is a big flat gong that hangs outside the dining room, rings before all meals to announce that it's time not only to come to the dining room, but if you're in the dining room, it's time to... Everybody stands up formally and waits for the end of the umpan before going to take their food. We're silent as we get our meals and take our seats, and then there's a sound signal of a clap, clap with wooden sticks that tells us now it's time to speak. Zen in particular emphasizes meditation practice. And meditation is silent. When you sit still and silent, and there's no particular stimulus, maybe there's a bird or somebody coughing, but basically there's not a lot of input. You might get a little input of like pain from your knee or discomfort from a bad dream or from something you did yesterday that you don't feel so good about or something you're hoping for that you have a fantasy about, all kinds of things. You get to notice this activity of mind that normally, if you're in the midst of activity, you're not really paying attention to, but it is going on. So the stillness and the silence allow me to recognize what's going on in the undertone, what's the hum, you know, that is coloring my experience of the world. It's not the kind of restless silence of being alone and wanting to have company. It's the silence of really being receptive and tuning in.
You don't have to be a practicing Zen Buddhist to tune into the silence of Green Gulch. The center offers free public programs every Sunday, including meditation instruction and a Dharma talk. You can also stay overnight at Green Gulch. For more information, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. And now for your sneak peek at next week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Four bells, table.
Four bells, table. Four bells, table.
So, if you know what's going on there and where we recorded it, call us and let us know. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll have the story behind the sound next Thursday here on Cross Currents, so tune in. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Linda Ju, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Ryan Miller, and Todd Whitney. Today's show was produced by Julie Kane and engineered by Seth Samuel and Maya DePaula Hanica. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. And a happy birthday to our engineer, Chris Hoff. Kronia Pola! This is the Patrick Wolf Sextet from San Francisco. Leader Patrick Wolf has been a jazz sideman on both coasts, and he also plays Mexican folk music and African high life. The Patrick Wolf Sextet will probably stick to jazz sounds when they perform this Saturday night at Duende in Oakland. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.